everyone. Welcome to Nuclear Matters at CIL, a series of podcasts brought to you by the Nuclear Law and Policy Team at the Center for International Law, or CIL. For more information on the center and this focus area, you may wish to listen to our introductory episode on Introduction to Nuclear Law and Policy, a new focus for CIL. Today's podcast is the fourth and last in a series of four episodes that will cover the fundamentals of the three S's, nuclear safety, security, and safeguards, and their interrelationships. I am Nivedita. Together with Denise Cheung, we will be continuing our conversation with our special guest, Dr. Charles Ferguson, on the fundamentals of nuclear safeguards and the interrelationships between the three S's. Dr. Charles D. Ferguson is the director of the Nuclear and Radiation Studies Board in the Division on Earth and Life Studies at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine based in Washington, D.C. He served as the president of the Federation of American Scientists for several years and was a senior fellow for science and technology at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he specialized on nuclear issues. He is the author of Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know, and the co-author of The Four Phases of Nuclear Terrorism. Given his background, Dr. Ferguson's scientific perspective on this area will provide a technical base for legal and policy discussions that will follow as part of this podcast series. Dr. Ferguson, having heard you explain and go through the concepts of nuclear safety and nuclear security in the previous episodes, we now turn to the last S, safeguards. What is nuclear safeguards?
Well, safeguards, the so-called third S, is designed to alert the authorities that there might be misuse of civilian peaceful nuclear power, a misuse being diversion of nuclear materials into a nuclear weapons program or a clandestine facility that's making nuclear material that could be used in a nuclear weapon. And this is a case, unlike safety and security, where there's discrimination, to be frank. And it's embedded within the governing treaty, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was enacted in 1970. So this treaty has been around for now 50 years. And if it wasn't for the COVID-19 pandemic, a month or two ago, delegates would have been meeting in New York City to talk about the last 50 years of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and where that Non-Proliferation Treaty and the regime itself for non-proliferation, it seems to be going and how it could potentially be improved. And so we have these different categories of countries. And there are basically three categories. There's most of the world, the quote-unquote non-nuclear weapon states that's signed on to the treaty and that have committed to have safeguard systems placed on their peaceful nuclear activities. And these safeguards activities include inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, coming in and doing regular inspections of facilities. There's a requirement to do accounting and monitoring of nuclear materials and then declare how much peaceful nuclear material a country has in its possession. And then that declaration can be inspected by this independent third party, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And so that's most of the world. We're talking about, 180-some countries that are in that system. Most of those countries don't have those types of nuclear facilities subject to inspection. Only a relatively small fraction, but still a few dozen of those countries have nuclear facilities that are subject to inspection. So even within that group of the vast majority of countries that are non-nuclear weapon states, only a relatively small fraction of them actually have safeguards inspections going on regularly. Then you have a group of countries, the special five, so to speak, the Also happened to be the P5, or the permanent five on the UN Security Council, the United States, Russia, China, People's Republic of China, France, and the United Kingdom. So those are countries that developed nuclear weapons prior to 1967. So there was a cutoff date embedded in the Non-Proliferation Treaty saying that if a country developed a nuclear explosive device or nuclear weapon prior to that date, it is quote unquote a legal nuclear weapon state. And if a country develops it after that date, it's in a third category. These are countries that have not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, but did develop nuclear weapons. And there are only a few of those countries: India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel. Now, Israel is kind of in a special category by itself because it has never declared that it has nuclear weapons, but it's widely believed in the Middle East and throughout the world that, that Israel does have those capabilities. So those four countries are not subject to the kind of comprehensive safeguards that the vast majority of the world are subject to. When I say comprehensive, I mean truly comprehensive, that a country like Iran, which has nuclear facilities, is obligated to declare all those facilities and its materials and to open itself up to regular inspections by the IAEA. And you know, we've been struggling with, you know, what inspections are good enough. You know, can we detect clandestine activities in a country like Iran or really any country in the world? And then with the special category of countries, India, Pakistan, North Korea, and Israel, some of their facilities have what are called, you know, kind of special safeguards applied to them. And so it depends on when those facilities were developed, when agreements were signed, and what kinds of special inspections could be placed upon those particular kind of facilities. So it's far from a comprehensive system for those few countries. And then we have the special category of the five that are declared nuclear weapon states, and they can have a voluntary safeguard system placed upon certain of their facilities. So it's encouraged by the International Atomic Energy Agency to have, you know, as many facilities as possible placed under safeguards. But there's no obligation that the nuclear weapon states have to actually place facilities under safeguards. It's more of a confidence-building measure. It's a way of signaling to the rest of the world or signaling to their rivals, hey, you know, not everything we have that's nuclear is in our weapons program. And so, you know, it's a way of developing some level of trust that we're kind of gradually working our way across the world toward a future where that there will be no nuclear weapons. And so, you know, that's the goal. And you know, the nuclear weapon states have signed up to that by their enactment of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And we're a long way to get that goal, but we have to remind ourselves it is the goal. It is agreed upon in the international system to achieve nuclear disarmament.
Thank you, Charles. Having heard what nuclear safeguards is, I'm curious, what is the relationship between nuclear safeguards and nuclear security and non-proliferation?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, the safeguard system is only one element of non-proliferation, of trying to prevent the further spread of nuclear weapons, and also even to try to achieve that goal of disarmament. And once again, it's this defense in depth concept applies to non-proliferation as it applies to safety and security, but it's a different set of mechanisms. And the mechanisms, by and large, are political mechanisms. There are also things like confidence building measures and, you know, declarations of what facilities can be inspected and which ones cannot. Arms control agreements, especially between Russia and the United States, has been a mechanism over decades to try to control the nuclear arms race and even to try to achieve reduction in the actual weapons themselves. Another major mechanism is what's called a security assurance. So alliances like NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is a mechanism where the United States pledges to countries within NATO that they will be protected and that they don't have to develop nuclear weapons themselves to have that kind of so-called ultimate deterrent that the United States can provide. Now, there are some other NATO members like the United Kingdom and France who developed their own independent nuclear weapons capabilities. So even within NATO itself, that deterrent protection of the United States is not foolproof. And, you know, a couple of countries have gone their own way. But by and large, most of the countries within NATO have benefited from the protections that the United States has offered through its military and its political system. Yeah, and you know, NATO is not the only political or military assurance system, so to speak. You know, the United States also has those security assurances with countries in other parts of the world, for example, Japan and South Korea, and those are countries that are in an area of tension with North Korea and China being nuclear armed, and then even in Southeast Asia, there are various types of security assurances that have also helped, I think, reassure countries that they don't have to develop these weapons themselves. And I think the safeguard system, coming back to that, and the efforts of the International Atomic Energy Agency, has been a mechanism to provide assurances to states. So if a country in, let's say, Southeast Asia may think, wow, you know, if I didn't have this system in place where I know that my neighbor is being inspected, then there might be too much uncertainty. I might feel that I have to hedge against a bad future, and I may need to have a quote-unquote bomb in the basement or the capability to make a nuclear weapon quickly because my neighbor might have the same capability. But in a system where you have regular inspections, you have declarations of nuclear activities, you have that transparency and those types of assurances through that system, then countries feel less pressure to have even a quote-unquote bomb in the basement.
Thank you, Charles. And when we were talking about nuclear security, you mentioned the possibility of a dirty bomb. Now, I'm just wondering, would a dirty bomb fall squarely within nuclear security, or would it fall within nuclear safeguards as a nuclear weapon?
Yeah, that's a great question. A dirty bomb is kind of in a gray area, so to speak, but I think of it, and I think most experts who think about nuclear security would say that a dirty bomb would be something that a nation state would not do. That being said, there is a history of certain nation states, including the United States and the Soviet Union back during the Cold War, early part of the Cold War, and even over 30 years ago, Saddam Hussein, when he controlled Iraq, they explored production of so-called dirty bombs or radiological disposal devices that could be used on the battlefield. I think the belief now among military leaders is that it's not an effective military weapon. So it's something that militaries would not develop and would not use. However, a terrorist group might be inclined to acquire a dirty bomb and use a dirty bomb because they might look at it as kind of a poor man's nuclear weapon. So, a way of kind of relatively easily acquired radioactive materials that could be fashioned into some kind of dispersal device through some kinds of explosives or some other mechanism like that. And that could create a lot of panic, could create contamination in a city, for example, and could lead to a lot of social disruption. So I think from that standpoint, a dirty bomb would fall into the area of security and protecting against a terrorist group from acquiring radioactive materials. And then I don't think the threat from a nation state is really much of a threat at all when it comes to a dirty bomb.
If I may follow up, Charles, what about INDs, improvised nuclear devices? How do we distinguish that from a dirty bomb? Is it the need to detonate, the need for a fission reaction for an explosion? Is that how you distinguish between them? And do we understand them to be on a scale?
Yeah, this actually gets into another book that I worked on and was published about 15 years ago called The Four Faces of Nuclear Terrorism. And I was the lead author of that book, and we have worked with a team of five people on it. And we set on this title, The Four Faces of Nuclear Terrorism. It was actually my boss at the time, Leonard Spector. Give him credit for the being the more literary of our group. And he said, you know, it kind of reminds him of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And so, because initially our project was called The Different Faces or The Differing Faces of Nuclear Terrorism. And then Mr. Spector said, oh, no. He said, you know, we only have four, and we should call it Four Faces to have that allusion to the four horsemen of the apocalypse. So the four faces of the four groups break into two categories. There are the radiological categories and the nuclear categories. Radiological include things that we've mostly been talking about in parts of this podcast, which are quote-unquote dirty bombs, or what's mostly known among experts as radiological dispersal devices, ways of kind of dispersing RDD, a way of dispersing radioactive materials. And then the other radiological threat is attacks against or sabotage on nuclear facilities. And so those are the two radiological categories. In terms of the scale of damage and the likelihood, you would have the dirty bomb RDD threat would be seemingly kind of the most likely thing that could happen in the nuclear space. And then next up in terms of scale and least likelihood, would be attacks on nuclear facilities. And then with the true nuclear threats, improvised nuclear devices or INDs, and acquiring an intact nuclear weapon from a nuclear weapon state, those would be acts of potential extreme violence, you know, could cause extreme damage. And of those two nuclear threats, the IND seems to be the most likely, because it could just be a use of just get some highly enriched uranium from, I don't know, a research reactor facility and, you know, slam these pieces of highly enriched uranium together very rapidly to create a supercritical mass of fissile material, and then there would be some kind of an explosion. And it wouldn't be a optimized kind of military weapon by any means, but it would be, could be very damaging. It could be, you know, a kiloton or maybe a 10 kiloton explosive yield. And for comparison, the atomic bomb that detonated Hiroshima was on the order of about, you know, that 10 to the 15 kiloton range. And it made use of this very simple design called a gun-type device that I was describing, where you slam together pieces of highly enriched uranium very rapidly. And then with a military weapon, these devices are very sophisticated. You know, they are building on decades of experience and billions of dollars in weapons program to design these sophisticated weapons. And so the explosive yield typically is much greater in a military weapon. But the kind of countervailing force is that there are more protection devices embedded within the military nuclear weapons. And so there are special codes that have to be entered to allow a terrorist group to actually use that particular weapon. And so that's the case where the most damaging event on the nuclear scale, the intact nuclear weapon, would be the least likely to actually be actualized and be implemented because of those security protections.
Charles, having covered the three S's, safety in episode 2, security in episode 3, and safeguards in the current episode, episode 4, it would be very helpful if you could, in closing, share with us your thoughts on the interrelationships between safety, security, and safeguards.
Yeah, it's this 3S system, and there's been a movement in, I would say, the last 10 years, maybe even somewhat longer, maybe in the last 20 years, to integrate the 3S's. And I've even been a part of putting forward some ideas with some of my colleagues. And sometimes the ideas, you know, stick, and sometimes they don't. So, you know, one idea is that we're in places where there are safeguards inspectors going to facilities, they should also be on the lookout for things that might cause them to be concerned about security. I posed this idea with a colleague of mine. This is, you know, several years ago, I would say probably about 5 or 6 years ago, to a senior official at the International Atomic Energy Agency. And that official, I won't name his name, but you know, he said, well, Charles, it's an interesting idea. You know, when someone says that, they're going to say, however. And you know, and it gets to what I was raising earlier about the issues of the workforce, and that we need to be careful not to burden our workers at dealing with nuclear activities with too much. And so I backed away from that idea. You know, I think he was right that, you know, safeguards inspectors have a lot to learn. They have a lot of responsibility. They have a lot to do when they go on inspection tours. So it's too much to ask them, in addition, to take on that security challenge as well. So I don't think that's a good idea. But I think in terms of national authorities and also international organizations like the International Atomic Energy Agency, that we do need to move more toward that integrated 3S system, where at the political and even the scientific technical levels, we can find ways where safety, security, and safeguards can enhance each other and not work at cross purposes. So that's extremely challenging. You know, I brought up some examples about how safety and security can sometimes work across purposes. But I think that what I'm saying at a minimum is there should be a commitment among national leadership that all three S's first need to be strengthened. There need to be adequate resources to ensure safety at nuclear facilities, to keep improving security, and it's a dynamic threat space, and keep improving safeguards. And improvement of safeguards also includes having the nuclear weapon states make more and more of their facilities subject to voluntary safeguards. So that's a way of building confidence. So it also does keep coming back to building more and more confidence. You know, it's a question of building that trust among all nations. And it is, you know, the old, you know, Russian proverb that President Reagan made famous, that's, you know, trust but verify. And so each one of those three S's also involves verification measures. That's why there are certain groups of specialized workers, safety inspectors, you know, security specialists, safeguards inspectors. And we shouldn't burden each of the three groups with doing too much, but they also need to recognize that each has its own special culture that needs to keep being strengthened and certainly integrated at the national levels and the international levels through organizations like the United Nations and the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Charles, just a quick follow-up, if I may. So you touched on the interface between safety and security and security and safeguards. Do you have an example where we can make the connection between safeguards and safety directly as we think about these interrelationships?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't have an easy answer. Maybe what comes to mind is a country I know a good bit about is Japan. And, you know, it's often said that if you have, safe nuclear power, and nothing's perfectly safe, but if you keep improving safety, that it could help with generating electrical power. And in Japan, there is this failure due to the safety myth. But I think Japan learned just the opposite, more important lesson with safeguards early on. And it developed once again through a crisis. So back in the late 1970s, during the Carter administration here in the United States, the Japanese government came to the United States government and said that, you know, we want to reprocess irradiated nuclear fuel to extract plutonium and recycle that material for new nuclear fuel. And the Carter administration had just issued a policy saying that they wanted countries to stop doing that activity because of the proliferation concerns. And so Japan was convinced to become a laboratory for developing safeguards. And so they now, I think, may need to draw on that history of how they open themselves up to a greater extent for more safeguards to instill confidence in the United States and other countries that they could do that activity responsibly. They need to learn a similar lesson in light of the Fukushima accident, which is, you know, now more than 9 years ago. But I think they are, you know, gradually learning that lesson, and it's a tough lesson to learn. And it's unfortunate that, you know, when it comes to safety and safeguards, it really has been crises in a few countries that have really shocked the system that have then led to further improvements in safety and safeguards. So I know I'm not quite making a direct connection between safety and safeguards, but I think I'm trying to argue by analogy that there are some good examples out there where a country that struggled with safety has done almost the opposite positive thing when it comes to safeguards, or even vice versa, and learning, you know, and hopefully, you know, trying to learn lessons from both fields that could be applied across the board in the three S's for further improvement.
So this brings us to the end of our four-episode series on the fundamentals of nuclear safety, security, and safeguards. Dr. Ferguson, we truly appreciate how you've made a complex topic accessible to those of us without a technical background. Your Swiss cheese analogy in the context of the defense in depth concept, we will always remember. The scientific perspective you shared has certainly deepened our own understanding of this area. And this will provide us with an excellent base for legal and policy discussions as part of this podcast series. So that leaves me to thank you on behalf of the Center for International Law, in particular our nuclear law and policy team. Thank you so much, Charles, for your time and all your insights. Much appreciated.
It's been my pleasure. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I wish you and the center the very best.
Thank you for listening to Nuclear Matters at CIL. If you would like more information on the topics discussed in our series covering the fundamentals of the three S's, Dr. Charles Ferguson has written a book titled Nuclear Energy, What Everyone Needs to Know, for anyone looking to learn more about the area. Have a great day.